Welcome to The Brain Architects. I'm Rebecca Hansen, Senior Director of Communications at the Center on the Developing Child at Harvard University. Our center believes that advances in the science of child development provide a powerful source of new ideas that can improve outcomes for children and their caregivers. By sharing the latest science from the field, we hope to help you make that science actionable and apply it in your work in ways that can increase your impact. In September, as part of our ongoing webinar series, we hosted a live conversation on the growing impact of wildfire smoke on young children. With the frequency and intensity of extreme wildfires more than doubling in the past two decades, smoke now poses risks to children's health and development far beyond active fire zones. The discussion highlighted how the LA Fire Health Study is working to better understand both the short and long-term effects of wildfire smoke, with lessons that extend to communities across the country. The conversation was hosted by the center's Chief Science Officer, Dr. Lindsay Burkhart, and featured Dr. Joseph Allen, Professor of Exposure Assessment Science at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and Sujit Rao, Director of the Health and Well-Being Practice for Public Exchange at the University of Southern California. We hope you enjoy listening to this conversation, and please remember to subscribe to The Brain Architects on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to be notified of future episodes. And without further ado, here's Dr. Burkhart.
Thanks, Rebecca. Thanks to everybody for being here today, for making the time to listen in. I'm going to start us off with some opening remarks, and then we'll turn to our two fantastic panelists. So we're going to focus today our conversation on how wildfire smoke is affecting early childhood development. And we really want to focus on strategies and solutions to talk about how we can protect young children and their caregivers. So many of us know wildfire smoke is already affecting young children's health today, and it's affecting their development. And these impacts are happening now in childhood, but they're also affecting children across their lifetime. And this is true for kids who live close to the site of where a wildfire occurs, but it's also really true for those who live hundreds and even thousands of miles away. And so many of us often think about the immediate danger from a wildfire itself, but there's also the smoke that wildfires produce that contain a really harmful mix of pollutants, and these can cause very serious health effects in young children. And when these pollutants enter the body, especially when it happens during pregnancy, infancy, and early childhood, they can really interfere with healthy development. Now, exposure to wildfire smoke is tied to some really important outcomes. Babies being born premature or being born too small or low birth weight, higher rates of asthma attacks in children, higher rates of respiratory infections, learning loss, and also really negative effects on children's mental health. And again, these effects can be felt immediately, but also across children's lifetimes. That's why it's really critical for all of us, whether we're practitioners or caregivers or community members, to focus on what we can do to protect kids immediately, as well as thinking about what are the long-term solutions that we can put in place. And when we really start to understand the science, we can explore practical solutions and think about how do we reduce children's exposure and support their healthy development, and also think about really building resilience in the places where our young children are living and learning and playing and growing. So today, I'm really excited to talk to Joe Allen and Sujit Rao. They're two voices in the field who offer different backgrounds and approaches to this work. And I think we'll have a great conversation today. So I'm going to start with Joe, and then we'll turn to Sujit. So Joe, could you briefly introduce yourself and share how you became connected to research focused on wildfire smoke and children's health?
Yeah, so thanks, Lindsay. It's good to be on with you again and here with Sujit, two friends and collaborators, and nice to be with you all. My background is really exposure and risk science. How do we think about what's in the air, water, soil, dust, and what does it mean for kids' health and what we can do to stay safe? I run Harvard's Healthy Buildings Program, so I think a lot about exposures in particular in homes and buildings and schools and what can be done to kind of minimize that risk. In terms of wildfires, really my team has been focusing on this for a long time, like everybody, I think, in the field of public health, as we see just the scale of the impacts increasing. But really, after the fires in Maui, our team responded very quickly to do a lot of research on what the indoor impacts would be from the fires and the immediate aftermath of those fires. Similarly, when the fires happened in LA, we're part of a really large group of really terrific scientists all across California and really across the country who really just mobilized and tried to pull whatever resources we could together to say, what can we do from an academic standpoint to get answers to the questions people have. How do I stay safe? What does this mean for my kids and their health? So I'm one of the co-directors of this LA Fire Health Study. I co-lead the exposures group, which really is about what's in the air, water, soil, dust. And the LA Fire Health Study is a 10-year health study to look at not only what is in the air, water, soil, and dust, but how it may be impacting the population over time.
That's great. Thanks, Joe. Sujeet, could you also introduce yourself and just tell us a little bit about your work around wildfires?
Yeah, happy to. Thanks for having me. So my name is Sujeet Rao, as Rebecca mentioned. I'm the leader of the health and well-being practice for a team at USC called Public Exchange. And what Public Exchange does is we build and manage collaborations between academic researchers and external partners with a focus on social impact. So I'll unpack each of those things. So essentially, our team, we are not academics by training. We have various backgrounds, some of us industry backgrounds, some of us nonprofit, some of us government and policymaking. And we sort of have sat in the shoes of our external partners that needed academic expertise or academic research for any number of real-world problems in the past. And so we bring that perspective to bear around these projects. I've been at USC for about 2 years. And before that, I served in the Biden White House on the COVID response team, sort of in a public health emergency posture. And so that background has been really relevant towards the work that my team has been doing in the post-wildfire context here in Los Angeles. We launched a project that we call CLEAN, Contaminant Level Evaluation and Analysis for Neighborhoods. It is the largest free soil testing program in LA County. We'll talk more about it a little bit later, but it really started with some work of earth science researchers at USC and public health researchers at USC who jumped into the fray in the post-wildfire context to apply their expertise and skills and equipment to help people answer critical questions about health. In this case, what was in the soil after the fires stopped burning?
Thanks, Sujeet. So let's get into it first with Joe. I want to make sure that we're all starting from a common ground in how we think about what's in wildfire smoke. So can you walk us through what's in this smoke and why does it matter for our health?
Well, yeah. So it's a couple of things. And I think Los Angeles is unique in the sense that it's an urban wildfire. But broadly speaking, we think about wildfire smoke. One of the things we're most interested in is something called PM2.5. Really just particulate matter that's airborne dust. And we're concerned about it because, one, it blankets the entire continent, really, as these wildfires hit wherever they originate. And we know a lot about the detrimental impacts or the harms of this kind of air pollution. So we know it can harm the lungs. Certainly, we see many studies looking at links between outdoor air pollution from wildfire-generated particles and things like COPD or asthma or even overall lung function. We've known for a long time that these particles and other pollutants in smoke can influence heart health. So we know there's an increased risk of stroke. We know there's an increased risk of heart attacks. And then also we know that it influences brain health. And I'll bring in a couple studies specific to kids. We know that there's evidence linking these outdoor air pollution impacts with things like older adults we care about, like Parkinson's dementia, but also some links between things like anxiety and depression, and some of my own team's work on links between outdoor air pollution like that and wildfire smoke and overall cognitive function performance. And I think what's concerning about, in particular, about a place like LA, not that we're just focusing on what's happening in Los Angeles, but, you know, as these wildfires grow in size and they encroach right up, in this case, right into our major cities, the mix of pollutants is quite different. It's not just brush and trees burning, but here you have cars burning, you have old homes burning. That releases different metals, like we saw in Los Angeles. The atmosphere and the smoke not just had these particles, but the particles were actually lead and arsenic and some other toxic metals. So the mix of pollutants varies, and we know that it, or even it may have asbestos from old homes. So the mix of pollutants varies based on where the fire is coming. We know a lot about these potential health outcomes, and then we're really been focused on trying to figure out what's going on when it's an urban wildfire and how that might be different from what we know about wildfire smoke. One last thing, Lindsay, I think is really important for this audience is that when we talk about wildfire smoke, we think about and we see pictures of these big plumes outdoors. Wildfire smoke penetrates into our homes, our schools, our offices, the places where we spend most of our time. So when we think about wildfire smoke and these health concerns, we should be thinking about what we need to do inside our homes, because that's where the pollutant ultimately reaches most of us. That's where most of our exposure happens, is in the home. And I know we'll talk a lot about strategies people can take in their homes to keep their kids safe.
Yeah, and can I ask you to expand on that just a little bit in terms of, you know, you mentioned PM 2.5. So that's a very small type of particle, right, that has the ability to sort of penetrate very deeply into our bodies. Are there other important things in smoke that you think about, whether they're gases or particles, or is that the most important one you think for us to focus on?
Well, it's a really good point. I think it's a lot about the particles. So thanks for clarifying these PM 2.5 or small particles we can inhale deeply in our lungs. We have seen also nanoparticles. These are even smaller particles that we absorb readily, and they'll pass through cells in our body and kind of, and they'll go wherever they want inside the body. We've seen that related to wildfires. There are a whole other mix of exposures we're concerned about, and particularly these chemicals or these volatile gases. We call them VOCs, for volatile organic compounds. So you have the particles like PM 2.5, and then you have some of these gases. What we've seen is that during the fire, you see an elevated level of not only these particles, but also these toxic gases. And importantly, after the fire's done, in homes that are impacted by smoke, if you happen to be close to one of these places where you have soot and ash, we see a continual off-gassing of those VOCs for many months after. So it's not just the mix of particles and gases that are toxic, but after this happens, after these fires, if your home was impacted by smoke, you can get that re-off-gassing of those VOCs. In fact, people will be familiar with this. If you ever walked into a home, or even if you're around a fire pit or something, or your clothes smell, or you're smelling after the fact, is that re-off-gassing of these volatile chemicals that'll absorb into all sorts of materials, and then they re-off-gas, and you smell, it's that smoke smell. What is that? That's that mix of gases that you're smelling, that you smell during an active fire, but also re-off-gassing off materials that were impacted in homes that are heavily impacted by smoke.
And the source of these things, it depends on, like you said, what's burning, right? So where do these VOCs come from? They're probably not in all wildfires, right? They're more common in the ones that happen when they burn near cities. Is that fair?
Well, the mix of the VOCs is very different when it's in what we call an urban wildfire, like we had in Los Angeles, same thing in Maui. We see these very frequently. And that's because of the mix of stuff we have in our homes, offices, schools, cars burning, all the products we have in our home that will, it's a really complex mixture of toxic gases. But also we have VOCs that are these chemicals that are also emitted from the larger wildfires. I think most of what we're looking for in the wildfire, though, when you see that smoke, you see that long distance transport. You have a wildfire in Canada, and you'll detect it where I am in Boston or New York. We can't quite see it. It's not like this overtly, it's not super cloudy out from the smoke. But sure enough, when we measure it, you see elevated levels of these particles mostly that'll travel many hundreds, if not thousands of miles.
Yeah, and I think that's such an important point because, you know, you and I are based in Boston and we don't think of ourselves as being in a wildfire-prone area. I mean, we've had fires in the area near my children's school a few miles away, but you know, the fires in Canada are hundreds, if not thousands of miles away, and the smoke can be just as toxic when it reaches us, which I think is, you know, important for people listening in who may think, I don't live in California. I don't live in areas where these fires burn all the time. I think these are affecting the health of children already who are living in areas that are quite far from the fire. So, you know, building on this a little bit, Sujit, can you talk a little bit about, you know, Joe and I mentioned some of these direct effects of the smoke exposure. What have you experienced in terms of, you know, your own experience or working with communities about some of these more indirect effects, like how fires are, you know, disrupting communities or daily life or kind of putting stress on caregivers and children?
Yeah. If we think of what happened here in Los Angeles in January, of course, you have the direct impact of fires that broke out. Wildfires, unlike some other sort of scary phenomenon, are quite sudden in some cases. And in particular, in this context that we had in January, they were quite sudden. And so the disruption that people felt was in the middle of the night. In some cases, they got evacuation orders and you had to get up and go. And that can be very disruptive in terms of what you necessarily had packed, how much time you had packed to get up and go. If you have young children, we're focused on young children to get them. In my own case, we live several miles away from the fire, so there was no direct threat from the flames. But in the middle of the night, as Joe mentioned, smoke travels and it gets into our house. And so our house filled with smoke and there was ash falling outside. I had a 3-month-old at the time and we had to get up and go because he was coughing. He couldn't breathe. We had all the air purifiers going and it was very kind of disrupted. There are thousands of people that were just like us who maybe were not necessarily directly impacted by the fires, but who were still sort of impacted in that way because there was a risk from the smoke. Similarly, if we think of what happens when these fires break out, there's a whole chain of effects that sort of impact people's lives in different ways. So in this case, earlier in the day when the fires broke out, there were evacuation orders. In the next days, there were evacuation orders from the air quality in schools. And so schools were closing, parents, buses were being sent all around. Parents were scrambling to sort of find their kids and pick them up wherever they may have been. Some schools, in some cases, one school burned down. Some schools were closed for a while because of different damage. So all of these sort of like big rocks in your life were all of a sudden a little bit unsettled. Joe, you mentioned sort of the anxiety that can come. If we think fast forward even a couple weeks when the flames had actually gone out, normally you might think, okay, you might feel a sense of relief. And of course, there was a sense of relief that the fires were no longer burning. But there were also these lingering questions of, well, what is remaining? What is in the air? And then soon after, what is in the soil? And so these sorts of uncertainties and questions create real anxieties for people when they're figuring out what to do next. When is it safe for me to go home? When is it safe for me to clean up and rebuild if my property suffered damage? And all these kinds of questions just, you know, increase the anxiety and the stress that people are feeling, which are indirect but are very acute. The last thing I'll say also is, in moments of tragedy like this, people need and often rely on their community to sort of lean on and lift them up and support them through difficult times. And in the case of the Palisades and in Altadena, the community was effectively gone. And so thousands and thousands of people who were directly impacted, who otherwise might, you know, want and need to lean on each other, were sort of scattered to the winds. And those important community institutions, community centers, churches, businesses, even grocery stores were gone. And so a lot of those, you know, those sort of tent poles to your community life were gone or were altered. And that creates all sorts of profound, indirect, lasting effects.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Sujit. And it makes me think too, you know, we talk a lot about direct effects of wildfire smoke on learning loss. Like, we know on days where children are more exposed to wildfire smoke, they actually don't perform as well on academic measures. But I think I'm really struck by what you had shared. And when you and I had talked about this before, about, you know, when these fires happen, some of the, like, schools burn down. And we think about the fire is over and the cleanup is happening, but that disruption and the effects on learning loss can persist for months, if not years, right? And those school systems are, I imagine, having to navigate, you know, having those students join into other nearby classrooms where they don't have the community or the support. And then those schools are going to have to adapt to the additional students. And it's sort of this interconnected web of these indirect effects.
Yeah, you really realize how reliant on each other we are in these moments when one of the big legs gets knocked out like that. And yeah, I mean, some of those effects are still being felt, right? Some of the schools are, like, as you mentioned, some schools have burned down. And so that student body is spread out across neighboring schools. There's temporary classrooms. You know, we're almost a year later and it's still quite disruptive in many important aspects of people's lives.
Yeah. And I think increasingly we're talking about how important just stability is for especially the young children. I mean, it's important for all of us. I think when our routines and our lives are disruptive, but young children in particular really thrive on predictable routines and having consistent caregivers, you know, knowing the same person and showing up in the same school and having access to these kind of really deeply interconnected sources of their essential needs. And when one's disrupted, you can just see how kind of the whole chain can cascade. So thinking so much about everyone who's still affected in Los Angeles and in Maui and all the places where these fires have occurred. You know, so Joe, we've talked a lot about air and smoke and now the kind of effects of this, you know, cascading disruption. And I think one area that I've learned a lot about from you is also this issue of contaminated soil after fires. So can you flesh out and talk a little bit more about the connection between wildfire smoke and what the fire is leaving behind and what we might think about is ending up in children's yards, you know, their homes or even in their playgrounds?
Yeah, so really important question. And Sujit and his team have been leading some of this free soil testing for the community, and he can tell you about the results. But I'll try to paint the picture a little bit about, like, why this is a concern. So for example, and I'll use Los Angeles as an example, this most recent, and it was really obvious during the fires that the fire and these particles we've been talking about were enriched in lead. So lead is a metal that's particularly neurotoxic to children, harms their development, harms IQ, has a whole host of other health effects. But the scientific community all noticed that the smoke had a lot of lead, probably coming from things like old lead-based paint in homes, some residual lead, old use of lead in gasoline. There's been a lot of lead around, but we saw it mobilized into the air. So what happens? You see these smoke plumes travel across Los Angeles and around the country when other fires happen. And then eventually the larger particles start to settle out. And they will settle out onto everywhere outdoors, sometimes on our roofs of our buildings, oftentimes at a park, a school, our yard. And so the question then becomes, well, what is in it? What are the levels and is it safe? And so the route of exposure, how kids are exposed to this, it happens in a couple of ways. I'll describe them. So really, when you're outside, kids and adults will be picking up soil on our hands all the time, kids more so than adults. And actually, it gets into their bodies, what we call incidental ingestion. Essentially, you eat it mistakenly, unintentionally. It transfers onto your food you may be eating with your hands or onto your lips. And we absorb a lot of lead that way. Another way that this lead in soil, for example, or other contaminants in soil can get into our bodies is that as we stir things around, kids are out there playing soccer on a field without grass cover, right? Those particles get resuspended, they get relifted into the air, and you can breathe them in again. We also can track the contaminants in soil into our homes. So this can happen on the soles of our shoes. Good idea to kick your shoes off as you're going to a house. The wind can blow it into our homes. So you have another pathway as some whatever's in the soil gets tracked into nearby homes. And there the same mechanisms can happen. Kids can touch the soil, or if it's not clean, I mean, they touch their dirt inside their home. If it has a contaminant from soil from outside, it gets in their body. That can be resuspended or relifted up, and you can breathe it in inside. So you have kind of the source of the fires emits all these pollutants. It settles out into soil. We can have direct contact with the soil by kids. It can be resuspended where they inhale it again and they track it into their homes. So we're trying to think about all these different pathways, try to understand what's in the soil, and then give people some tools for how to stay safe, how to keep their kids safe if the soil is contaminated.
Right. And, you know, I know when I'm in clinic and I'm talking with people about decreasing children's lead exposure, because we have a lot of older lead paint in Boston and we have similar, you know, it can get peeled from windowsills or tracked in from dirt outside. You know, the two things that I tend to focus on are wet wiping, taking off your shoes, wiping down hardwood surfaces in children areas where children play, and then wiping their hands before they eat. All right, like for people who, you know, are communities and caregivers who are recovering after a fire, I imagine like the amount of information coming out about the things to be worried about may feel like really overwhelming. So are there other suggestions that you would make about practical steps that people can take following a wildfire? You know, if people are listening in and are practitioners or community members to decrease their exposure.
Yeah, so I think you nailed it. And the way I've been framing it is control the dust and control the air. So you have that, control the dust. Definitely kick off your shoes as you come indoors, wipe down paws of pets. So you're not bringing any of that contaminated soil, regardless of what the source is, into the house. I think it's a great idea to wet wipe or damp wipe surfaces. That's smart. I really like the idea of using a vacuum that has a HEPA filter. So a lot of vacuums maybe pick up the Cheerios you drop on the floor. I'm a parent of three kids, but it'll kind of redisperse smaller particles into the air. So a vacuum as a HEPA filter will pick up the big stuff, but also pick up the small stuff. And it'll prevent it from blowing out the back of the vacuum and kind of floating around the house. So if you can, get a vacuum with a HEPA filter. I think that's good for the control of the dust part of this. In terms of controlling the air, it's always a good idea to upgrade the level of filters in your home. So you can do this if you have a central air conditioning system or a central system. You want to upgrade to what we call a MERV 13 filter, MERV, MERV 13 filter. That's an upgraded filter. It captures more of those particles. And you can also use a portable air cleaner with a HEPA filter. So HEPA filter captures 99.97%. Maybe you've seen that on a box at the store. It's a really effective filter for capturing these particles. So I think if you do a good job of controlling the dust that enters in your house by the surface and kicking off the shoes, and you have some of these air filters going, that way if anything does get kicked back up when the kids are playing or you're just active in your house, you have filters that are kind of taking any of these particles right out of the air pretty quickly. I think if you do that, that goes a long way to reducing your kids' exposure to whatever's in the soil. And the hand washing. Sorry, you're on it. Yeah. Hand washing before you eat. Yes.
It all comes down to hand washing, right? In public health. Because to your point, you know, we think about, and I even phrase the question as, you know, the lead is in the soil, in the playgrounds or in our yards, but we spend, you know, more than 90% of our time indoors. And so these things that are outdoors, whether it's air or soil, they come indoors. And, you know, you and I authored a paper with one of our scientific councils earlier this year. And one of the questions that we get, we talk about the paper the most is like, where do we find, you know, the filters that you're talking about? How do you choose these things? And I know you have links to all these things on your website and your Healthy Buildings program so people can find them if they're interested.
Sure. If you just search Harvard Healthy Buildings, we have a nice little tool to help pick an air cleaner. You know, you got to size it right. It doesn't make sense to have a small air cleaner in a big room. And then we talk about the different types of filters you look for. But you can get these filters, these upgraded filters, these MERV 13 filters. You can get the local hardware store. They're not very expensive at all. They do a really good job. They're better than the typical filter that comes with your system. So if you haven't changed your filter recently, go down to the local hardware store, go online, look for a MERV 13 filter. Very good. And you can also look for a portable air cleaner with a HEPA filter. If you size it right for the room, and there's guidance on most of the manufacturers will have it right on the box, you can really get what we call like 2, 3, 4, 5 air changes per hour. So essentially you're filtering that air in the room 5 times every hour. That's pretty amazing. You can think about what you're actually doing. You're constantly cleaning that air. This way, if anything gets stirred up, anything blows in from outside, you're capturing on that air really quickly and capturing on the filter so it doesn't go into the lungs of kids or anybody else in the house.
Yeah. It's one of the reasons I love these conversations, because there's actually actionable things that we can do today that, you know, people can put in place, which is, I think, really uplifting when we sometimes can feel like these are really big problems to face. So, you know, we've talked a lot about the health impacts. Let's shift a little bit to how, you know, the LA Fire Health Study is studying them more locally. And so you mentioned, Joe, the study launched earlier this year and is really working to try to understand better the impacts from the recent LA wildfires, including the effects on young children. And the study is really addressing this urgent need for answers, I think, that the LA community articulated. But it has implications for communities all around the United States. As we mentioned, all of us are increasingly navigating the effects of wildfire smoke on young children. And, you know, the study is ongoing and, you know, it's early, but the findings are being shared, I think, really impressively, rapidly through briefs, webinars. There's a lot of incredible resources on the study website, helping communities begin to act now to reduce their exposure and to support caregivers and to protect young kids' health. So, Joe, can you just start us off? Like, how did the study begin? What was the need you feel like that sparked it? And how is it possible to bring together such a large group of institutions to collaborate so quickly?
So maybe let's start with that last question first. You know, how is it possible? I just think that's the easy part. I think there's people like Sajid and our colleagues all over California, these great universities and across the country who basically, you know, says, how do we help? Anytime there's a crisis in the country, you see the universities all kind of stand up and say, what resource do we have? How do we help people even before the funding? So that's been the easy part, honestly. It's just a lot of well-meaning people from all these universities contributing their expertise, trying to answer the questions that are coming from the community, really. Things around, you know, what do I do to stay safe? Is it safe to keep this piece of furniture after it had smoke? And a million other questions they have, understandably. So the LA Fire Health Study is specifically focused on what do we know or what can we learn about the short and long-term health effects associated with wildfire smoke. So despite earlier in our discussion, we rattled off a whole bunch of things we're concerned about in terms of wildfire smoke. There's most of that is around for some of these non-urban wildfires or what we know about just general outdoor air pollution. So we're trying to figure out with this study is if we really start to characterize this Los Angeles fire in a way that's never been characterized, really understand everything that's in water, measure things that haven't been measured before, and then follow people for a long time, leveraging all the great work from the universities and healthcare centers in Southern California. You know, what can we actually learn such that this is going to keep happening? We can get information out to the public on what they can do the next time or even in Los Angeles, what people can do to reduce their risk. So that's really how it came together. We're really grateful that we were funded by a philanthropist. So it's the Spiegel Family Foundation. Evan Spiegel, the founder of Snapchat, is a resident of the Pacific Palisades, really cares about Los Angeles, obviously cares about not just Pacific Palisades, but also Altadena and the whole community, and really felt it was important to kind of help lift up all of this research from all these academics and universities with our community partners to get answers to these questions. So that study started while the fires were active, right? We were gathering with everybody, getting all the scientific partners together, and we were grateful to have some philanthropic funding. Because I'll tell you a key difference is that when I responded to the fires in Maui, the National Science Foundation funded a dozen, maybe 20 different research projects. So the federal government funded a lot of the research projects. That has not been the case for Los Angeles. So it's largely been funded by philanthropy. And I know Sujit can talk about the work he's been doing specific to soils, which has a similar background. So anyway, that's where we came together, just trying to do our part and help the people of Los Angeles. And then through those learnings, help everyone else everywhere just understand how do we stay safer from these threats of wildfire smoke during the active fire, but also in the weeks and months after.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Thanks. So, Sujit, you shared earlier that your work's really bringing together researchers, policymakers, community members. How is your group collaborating with the LA Fire Health Study? You know, Joe mentioned your work really making sure that the voices of families and communities are part of this process.
Yeah, it's probably helpful. I'll tell you a little bit more about the project and how it's working, because our origin story is very similar to the LA Fire Health Study, as well as Joe sketched out. So our project, again, is called Clean Contaminant Level Evaluation and Analysis for Neighborhoods. What the project is basically a free soil testing project available for anyone in LA County. So not just those who were directly impacted by the fires in the burn zones, but really anybody everywhere. And part of the reason we're doing that is because the smoke and ash had such a large footprint. So many people were exposed to smoke and ash, even if they weren't directly in the path of the fire or in the burn zone itself. The origin of this, what the project involves is people collect the soil sample from their own home or a school or a playground, a place that's important to them. They fill out a survey on our website, get a little code. They write the code on the bag. You drop it off in a drop box. We've got about half dozen drop boxes across the county. Our team picks it up and we test those samples primarily for lead, using a methodology called X-ray fluorescence, where you basically take the sample, you dry it out, and you point a machine at it, and it tells you very quickly but reliably the level of lead that may be present in or that is present in the soil sample. We've been doing this for a few months, and we have tested more than 3,000 samples so far. We're not slowing down. We're going to keep collecting samples through this year and into next year so that as people put the pieces back together and start to recover, and they think about rebuilding, they have a good sense of what the lead levels may be in the soil so that they can think about what they can do next, which we'll talk about in a moment. But back to the origin, this project began the same way that LA Fire Health Study began, which is the sort of initiative of USC researchers who took it upon themselves while the fires were still burning and shortly thereafter to go out and start collecting some samples of roadside dust and other places to get a sense of what the levels of contaminants may be. And as they were going out and doing that, they kept hearing over and over from people they encountered in the community, well, can you test the soil in my backyard? And from that was birthed this project where anyone could submit their own samples to what we're doing. As we got up and running, we're very grateful to receive support from the Fire Aid Fund. That was a benefit concert that was put on here in Los Angeles after the fires. And so we received a generous gift from them that helps us really scale up what we're doing. So we're going to be collecting 10,000 samples over the course of this next year, as I mentioned, and testing them for lead as well as some other contaminants as well. The other piece of the puzzle that's important to mention is our team has earth science researchers who are doing the actual soil testing, but it also has public health researchers who are taking the results and helping people understand, okay, I know that the lead level in my soil is this much. What does that mean? What does that mean for me? What does it mean for the health of my family and my children? And most important, what are some next steps that I can do? And Joe mentioned, and Lindsay, you mentioned a few of them, of, you know, simple things like washing hands and mopping and using a vacuum with a filter. But there are other questions around the soils in the yards that and what sorts of steps people can take to keep themselves safe going forward. And we'll talk about that in a minute.
Yeah. I'm curious, how do you get the word out to people? Like, how do you let communities know that this is, you know, something that's available to them? And I'm also curious what you've experienced in terms of demand and interest when people do.
Yeah. This is where the collaboration with community leaders and policymakers becomes so important, because everybody has a platform. Everybody has, you know, the different groups, whether they're organically formed or put together, informal, formal. There's a million different groups and chat groups and email lists and events. And we're just trying to make sure that everybody's aware that this program is available and that it's not going anywhere, so that when these questions arise in authentic conversations that people are having, people have the answer and they can say, well, actually, there's a number of programs that are available, including this one from USC, where people can go and get their soil tested for free. I think another that touches on another aspect, though, which is the unique role that a university can play in this role, which is sort of providing expert advice a little bit at a distance, right? We're not necessarily like a company that somebody hired to clean up their property. And we're not, you know, we're sort of neutral third-party observers. And so that's something that's really a really important application of university researchers' skill and expertise, is to provide that kind of validated, independent, trusted source of analysis and opinions here.
Yeah, no, that's incredible. And it's amazing, actually, like, to hear those numbers. You said you've done 3,000 and you have plans for 10,000.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, we're not slowing down anytime soon. The demand has been steady. I think when we first launched this program 4 or 5 or 6 months ago, there was a huge kind of pent-up demand, I think. And one of the factors that played into that is similar to what Joe mentioned of, in the past, the federal government funding a lot of research in this space. In the past, what normally happens in a situation like this is the federal government does a lot of testing after they've kind of scraped and cleaned up the soil for places that burned. For a number of reasons, that's not happening in this case. And so you had this tremendous need in the community for answers from people about what the level of contamination may have been in the soil. So when we first launched this program, and there are several others, including one led by our collaborators and colleagues at UCLA, there was a lot of people that wanted information. And so we had this crush of people who submitted samples right away.
And you discouraged me before, but it's not like, it's not very labor intensive for people to collect the samples, right? And they kind of drop it in a mailbox. It's pretty easy for them to do.
Yeah, it's very simple. Essentially, we have some instructions and we have a video that kind of helps you understand how to collect the sample. But in a nutshell, you wear some gloves, you get some goggles in some cases if necessary. You get a couple Ziploc bags, you get a plastic spoon, you scoop maybe a quarter cup of soil from areas of importance. If you're covering a large area, you may want to grab, you know, a few spoonfuls from different areas and put it in one sample. You then drop that off at a drop box. We have one near both burn zones, but also all throughout the county as well. You can also mail them to us if you want. And then within about 2-3 weeks, our team will process and post the results that we found. We email you when those results are ready. We've mapped our results on a map with a certain level of abstraction so as to protect people's privacy. And you can also get a visual sense of kind of where samples are coming from if you visit our website. If you just Google Public Exchange Clean Project, you'll find it. You get a nice website that gives you a sense of where samples are coming from and what the levels that we're finding from. So far, we, as I mentioned, we've tested about 3,000 samples so far, and the news has been better than we may have feared, but it also underscores the importance of testing. So we found that about 42% of the samples that we have tested have had lead levels at or above the sort of safety screening threshold that the state of California sets. That doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, everybody has to take action above then, but it does mean that it's important to know what's in the soil. The other thing we've observed is that there's no obvious pattern to know whether our property is going to have an elevated level of lead or not, which underscores the importance of testing. And the good news is the testing is free and easy and very accessible. So I would encourage everybody to go out and participate in ours and other programs that are available, just so that they have information that can equip them and help them decide what to do next.
Lindsay, I can add to that on this measurement thing, because I, you know, what Sajid and we're trying to do in Los Angeles, I think is different than what's happening everywhere. But for people who aren't in Los Angeles, who are maybe thinking about, you know, what's in their home or what's in the air at their home, there are some other tips. There are ways to measure that similarly and pretty low cost. As Sajid said, the soil sampling, pretty straightforward and easy. I know a couple of university programs where it doesn't cost that much to test the soil for things like lead. And you can also use an indoor air quality monitor inside your home. they'll give you a sense of these airborne particles we talked about. So for example, even where I am in Boston, wherever you live, you have one of these low-cost air quality sensors. I can actually see in my house when a wildfire event from Canada or anywhere else is kind of blowing by. Maybe I can't see it with my eyes, but the sensor is kind of tracking and tells you, hey, you know, the air quality is changing inside your home. Time to upgrade that filter and make sure the filters are running. So outside of what's happening in Los Angeles, there are still some pretty low-cost ways to test your soil for lead and also test your air quality right inside your house to see if your level of filters are working or if you're being impacted by a wildfire smoke event.
You said they're through academic institutions? Like, how would people find them if they were interested?
So I know of one that I've used out of University of Massachusetts has a soil testing program, really for like gardeners too, if you're interested in the pH of your soil. But I've done this. I had kids in Boston, old home with a lot of lead-based paint on the exterior paint. And right at the drip line, so where water comes off the outside of the paint of the house, we saw very high concentrations of lead in soil in the house I was in. So it's not just indoor paint that's the problem. So you can have so high levels of lead in soil. Anyway, I leveraged this program at the University of Massachusetts, which was really about just overall soil health. I think it was like $40 or $50. I could check the price. But essentially, while they tell you about the soil health, they'll also give you the list of metals. There might be some even lower cost ones, but I know, for example, that's one I've used in Massachusetts. It's not a Massachusetts program. It's just a service offered by the University of Massachusetts. So I've used them before. They give you simple instructions. As Sujit said, you basically collect some soil, put it in a bag, or a little canister, ship it off. It's relatively low cost. And that's how we found out actually that the house I was in with my kids had very high levels of lead in the soil, and it was from the drip line.
You know, Sujit mentioned the soil thresholds. And so I want to dig into that a little bit because, you know, we know there's no level of lead exposure that's considered, you know, safe for children, but policymakers still have to go out and set guidelines and tell people when it's considered acceptable for families to come back to their home environments if they may contain lead or for children to go back to preschool. So can you talk about, you know, how these thresholds have been set in the past, you know, and why you think it's time to rethink them? And, you know, I'll just note for people listening in, and we'll drop in the chat a recent commentary that Joe and I, together with others, authored in Nature about perhaps why we need to rethink these thresholds, particularly when it comes to considering young children.
Yeah, I mean, in particular, as you know, there's no safe threshold of lead, as you've talked about. And I think as we've seen for lead, whether it be setting standards for lead levels in kids' blood or worker levels, we've just been dropping the safety threshold consistently for the past forever. Because we're recognizing there really is no safe threshold. So actually, when we were looking at some of the soil data of lead in Los Angeles and elsewhere, and I was asked questions by the community, hey, what is a safe threshold? We started to dig into the thresholds that are being used, and we think there's lots of improvement or a lower threshold is actually going to be better and a lot more protective. And the reason is really, I think, straightforward. One is the lead thresholds, so lead in soil thresholds, are really based on protecting the developing child's brain. And largely, it's specifically, at least in California and elsewhere in the country, around protecting against a one IQ point drop in kids. Well, we know that's not necessarily a great health target. We should be a lot more stringent than that. That's way too late to be finding out there's a problem. Also, we know that lead impacts way more than the brain in the developing child in particular. Second, when we actually looked into the standards, we realized they're based on a lot of old science, some studies going back for over 40 years that are honestly a bit shaky. So like scientists have done forever, when we start looking at the science that underpins some of these thresholds, we did that. And we're recommending a lower threshold for lead in soil based on updated science and really a more protective look at what we know the potential health impacts are on kids. We think it should be lower than it currently is. And I would guarantee that in a couple of years, the new threshold we set that's lower than the current one will be found to be too high. Mm-hmm. Almost certainly. A lot of it's driven by what's possible. Look, there's lead, there's contaminated lead all over the country from decades and decades of use of lead and paint, and primarily from lead and gasoline. So it becomes a problem if it's everywhere. How do you correct how do you address it all everywhere? You know, there's not infinite resources to fix all the soil lead issues around the country. But still, as scientists, I think it's on us to reevaluate the science as new data becomes available and recommend more stringent thresholds when the science suggests that. And I think in this case, it's really clear that the threshold should be lower. And I'm certain that we'll look back on this and others will say the threshold we chose is not protective enough. I that's guaranteed.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. I agree with you. You know, Sujeet, what support is out there? Can you talk about, like, if these thresholds are high, if they exceed the threshold, people get their soil tested, you know, what can people do if they realize that there's a level of concern?
Yeah, I mean, I think first and foremost is regardless of the threshold, as Joe mentioned, like, we know that it is important that you ensure that children especially are not exposed to over a prolonged period of time lead in soils or lead in paint or lead really anywhere. And so that's why one of the first things that I think people can do is to minimize the exposure. And whether that means the measures that we talked about washing hands and wiping things down, but also if there's lead present in the soil, there's a number of things you can do in your property, some of which you need sort of expert help with, but you can imagine, depending on the levels, you know, scraping and removing some of the contaminated soil and replacing it with fresh, clean soil. You can, depending on where it is on the property, you could cover it up with, you know, mulch and new layers of soil to avoid the actual exposure with skin or with by ingesting it. In some cases, there are plants and different things that you can plant that sort of help draw up some of the metals, and then you can just dispose of them safely after a period of time. So there's really a whole suite of solutions that people can access. You know, I'm part of a team along with Joe and some others that's working on how we can really scale this up and bring this to make this really widely available at low cost or in free in some cases for people all across the area. So stay tuned on that. We're still working on it. But it is the case, you know, the bad news is that there's no safe level of lead exposure. The good news is there's lots of things that we can do to keep ourselves and keep our families and keep our children safe from the negative effects that result from it. And so that's where we're really focused on.
Yeah. Thanks, Sujeet. So, Joe, we're talking about lead here, but there's, like you said, there's so many things, both in the smoke and in the ash that settles. Like, how broadly do people know when it's safe to return to homes or to reuse playgrounds if they're in the proximity of a fire?
Yeah, I think we have to distinguish between, you know, what we're doing like in Los Angeles and homes that are like heavily impacted by soot and ash, homes that are adjacent versus a broader conversation of what happens when there's wildfire smoke or the EPA says outdoor quality is bad, what can I do in my home? In the last example, if you hear there's bad air quality, if you can see bad air quality, if sunsets look a little better, a lot of times that's because of bad outdoor air pollution, make sure you have air filters going in your home. But this scenario we're talking about when it's like highly impacted, you see soot and ash, I would recommend finding a professional first to be sure we're being very careful about you before you go into these heavily impacted homes. You should have proper respiratory protection. You should have proper cleanup protocols. This is not something you just take a vacuum out and kind of put a paper mask over your face and you think that's okay. That's really a different level, I think, because the contaminants are really quite different. We know in Los Angeles, because of this urban wildfire, there's lead. There was a concern about asbestos. There's new concern about something called hexavalent chromium. So chromium is naturally found in soils. It's used in many different consumer products. The hexavalent or chromium 6 is a converted form of chromium that's a lot more toxic. We're just seeing this in Los Angeles during the cleanup phase. Not quite sure what's happening right now. But all that to say is that it's just a complex mixture of these pollutants. And if you're in a highly impacted space, you need to be extra careful. If you're a little further removed, these precautions we're talking about make sense. I will say this, and it'll build on something Sujeet said, that while we're still learning a lot about these health effects and exactly what's in the mix, and it's going to be different versus Los Angeles, versus Maui, versus Canada, or anywhere else, the control measures we're talking about, the steps people can take are the same. And they help regardless if we're talking about lead or arsenic or PPM 2.5, these airborne particles, right? It's some of these basic control measures. One, you want to control that dust, control air, specifically indoor air, and measure. So measure what's in your soil if you're concerned. Have a low-cost air quality monitor in your house so you can know if it's being impacted. And then for homes that are highly impacted, absolutely try to hire a professional, leverage some of these services that are out there to determine really what's in your home that would need a kind of professional layer of cleaning and remediation.
Yeah. So, you know, I'd love to hear from both of you, maybe Sujeet first. It feels like there's a lot of, you know, it's still very early and we're still gathering a lot of information, but I imagine that there's a lot that you've already learned that from this work that we can use to advocate for improvements, whether it's policies to protect people proactively or everyday practice or in cleanup. You know, what do you think that the important takeaways will be?
I think one of the important takeaways that we already know is the importance of soil testing in the case of our project, but really, as Joe mentioned, the importance of measurement overall in helping inform, you know, when it is safe to return, what may need to be done for a cleanup purpose, even just determining the footprint of exposure from something like a wildfire. I think, you know, we have great measures of air quality and air quality sensors and things like that, but what else do we need to start to think about doing to make sure that people are safe? And I think one thing we already know is, like, in places that are directly impacted, that had smoke, that have ash, that have soot, as Joe mentioned, some form of soil testing, I think, is an important step in recovery and in kind of aftermath. And thankfully, as Joe mentioned, there are fast, easy, reliable, relatively inexpensive ways to do this. I think we just have work to do to sort of build up the systems to support that as kind of an automatic step in the process. But we already know the importance and the ease with which we can do this at large scale. I think the challenge going forward will just be like, okay, how can we change people's expectations and change the conversation where this becomes something that it, maybe if it's not automatic, is at least kind of built into a process that gets deployed afterwards.
Yeah. Thanks, Joe. Anything you would add there?
Yeah, well, I agree with Sujeet. The other thing I'd add, which I'm not sure we learned from the recent fires, but is getting a lot more attention, is we have to start talking about wildfire smoke as an indoor air quality problem. Mm-hmm. If you think about Los Angeles, right? Millions of people were impacted by smoke. When we have these Canadian wildfires right now, millions of people across the U.S. are impacted by wildfire smoke. When I see guidance given, it's usually pretty good. But it's usually like, go inside, don't exercise if it's a bad outdoor air pollution day. But rarely, if ever, do I see the guidance say, well, also those particles will come in your house or school. So you need to be filtering that air. As you mentioned, Lindsay, 90% of our breaths happen indoors. Well, that outdoor air pollution penetrates inside, and it surprises a lot of people. This fact surprises a lot of people. Most of the outdoor air pollution you breathe happens inside. That sounds wrong, but it's correct. And so we need to start thinking about wildfires and smoke as an indoor air quality issue. And we saw this in Los Angeles. The first time we had over 1,000 homes with live indoor air quality measurements during the fires. And sure enough, they all had very high levels of smoke indoors. And not just the homes that are right where the fires are happening, across Los Angeles. As important, we also have information that when buildings and homes and schools use these filters we're talking about, it starts to separate the relationship between the bad outdoor air quality and what's happening inside. So in other words, in a home that doesn't have good filters, when outdoor levels go high, your indoor levels go with it. In a home with good levels of filtration, outdoor levels can go up and yours may nudge slightly up or even just stay very low. We see this over and over again. So I think coming out of this, I hope it's like to Sujeet's point about what's the playbook going forward. Yes, we need to test a lot more and soils have to be part of that for sure. I also know and think we have to get guidance out to people that the indoor air matters just as much. Some basic filtration, which is not expensive, can really go a long way. And we have now devices where we can measure in our homes that we didn't have before. We don't just have to rely on EPA's kind of regional monitors to get a sense of what's happening around us. We can actually know what's happened in our school, in our classroom, in our home, in the preschool. We know if the filters are working because the air quality, we have a way to measure it now. And we never really had that before, but I think that has to be part of the playbook and conversation going forward when we think about wildfire smoke.
This is great. Thank you both so much. It was a terrific conversation. I really appreciate the expertise that you both brought to the table. As always, I learned a ton. Thank you so much for being here and to everybody who's listening in. I'm going to turn it back over now to Rebecca for our closing remarks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Brain Architects. Be sure to check out the Center on the Developing Child's website at developingchild.harvard.edu. where you can find links to our social channels, sign up for our newsletter, and learn more about the connections between climate change and early childhood development. You can also explore a range of topics related to early childhood, from toxic stress to the importance of the developmental environment, and much more. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time.